Today we continue in our study of the teaching of our Lord Jesus in the parables of Luke. Again, I need to say to those of you who are here with us for the first time that we systematically expound the teaching of the Lord Jesus from week to week. And we have been studying the parables of our Lord Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. And today we have come to Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. This parable is generally known as the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, the publican. And if you use an authorized version of the English Bible, I hope you know that a publican is not a bartender, but a tax collector. In England, when you say publican, it generally means somebody who is a bartender in the pub, in the public house. And so it gets a little bit confusing when you say Pharisee and publican. They immediately think of the guy who is a bartender in the public house where they serve wine and drink. And then they wonder, oh, so they had public houses in Israel at that time too. They all went in for a booze. No. Publican is a tax collector. The one who went about collecting taxes and was very much despised by the Israelites because they were regarded as servants of the Roman power and therefore as traitors to their own country and irreligious people who had no conscience, who cared nothing for the welfare of the people of God, the people of Israel. So we study today Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. And this is how this passage reads. Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. So the Lord Jesus said, two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank thee that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. I should point out to you that the translation is the sinner, not a sinner. But the article has been lost in the translation. The sinner is very important. He does not regard himself as just one sinner among many, and therefore God can say, well, you are just one sinner. After all, there are a million sinners. Who worries about another one? No. He is under such deep conviction of sin that he says, I am the sinner. I am the sinner par excellence. I am the worst sinner of all. Nobody is a sinner like me. I am the sinner. And very much expresses the sentiment of the great Apostle Paul. I am the chief of sinners, the Apostle Paul. I am the chief of sinners. Not I was the chief of sinners. I am the chief of sinners because I persecuted the church of God. The Apostle Paul, before he became a Christian, was an enemy of the church. And in fact, many Christians lost their lives at his hands. He never forgot that. Even if God forgave him that, and he knew he was forgiven, but he never forgot what he had done. I am the sinner. And this is what the tax collector is saying. And then the Lord Jesus says in verse 14, I tell you this, this man, this tax collector, went down to his house justified, that is forgiven of his sins, rather than the other, that is the Pharisee. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, that is humbled by God, what is known as the divine passive. humbled by God. And everyone who humbles himself will be exalted, that is, exalted by God. Now this passage, I'm sure that superficially seems to be well known to us. And those who went to Sunday school would say, oh yeah, in Sunday school we know that picture, we know that story. Question is not whether you know the story, whether you know what it means. What does it mean? Essentially, this parable is about attitudes of the heart. And that is what we shall study together today. There is nothing so important in life as the right attitude. I say that again. There is nothing so important in life as having the right attitude. Attitudes are the greatest importance of life. You see, it is not so much the events in life that we have to face, and everybody has to face different kinds of events, different circumstances, different problems. It is not so much the events that matter as the way we deal with those events. That is, what is our attitude to those events? I wonder if you grasp what I'm saying. Let me put it to you like this. Two people facing exactly the same situation can have an entirely different attitude towards that situation. Let's say there are two people, and how many people there are like this, but let's say there are two people who have lost everything they had. They have lost everything, say through war, through personal disaster, through sickness. Many people lose everything they have in this life. That's not an uncommon experience. I lived through a couple of wars. I was a small boy during the Second World War. And I also lived through the War of Liberation when the communists came. I have seen people lose everything, everything. We used to have big houses, big cars, and they went out with nothing. Nothing but the clothes on their back. I also came out with nothing but the clothes on my back and a small suitcase. Now, given the same situation, you can have two distinct attitudes. One person loses everything and he is left with the clothes on his back, $2 in his pocket. And the one says, I am finished. I am finished. This is the end of me. I have lost everything. I've only got $2 left. I'm in despair. I'm in ruin. The other person looks at the same situation and says, I have lost everything, but I'm still alive. But I still have $2. One says, I have only got $2 left. The other says, I still have $2. It's not the end. I still have $2. Oh yes, and I still have my life. Now that is exactly the same circumstance, but two distinctly different ways. One is broken and finished. The other person is still with it. He is still hanging on. Now, last week we studied the parable just before this, the parable of the unjust judge. And we saw that the right attitude of the Christian, no matter how adverse, how hopeless the circumstance seems, the Christian hangs on. He is not going to give up. He is not going to give up. But I don't see all Christians behaving like this. I see so many Christians, when they face a difficult and admittedly very bad situation, they just crack up. Where is your God? I would say to this kind of Christian. What sort of a God have you? I have seen non-Christians who faced with this kind of situation still pull themselves together and said, okay, it's bad. But we'll make a go of it. We are going to pull through this thing. Even if we die in the process, we'll pull through. Now, even non-Christian can have this kind of attitude. What shall we say of Christians who seem to be broken by some difficulty, who say, I give up, I surrender, it's finished. I say to you that such a Christian does not know his God. Such a person does not deserve the name of a Christian. Doesn't deserve it. Because no Christian who knows God and ever lose hope. Put yourself back to that position. One person has lost everything. He's got only $2 left. Now, a non-Christian can say, if he's still an optimist, he can say, well, I'm still alive. It's true, I've lost all my houses. I lost my house, my possession, my land, my cars, whatever. I've lost everything. It's true. I'm still alive, though. And I still have $2, maybe. But look at the Christian. He's not only still alive, he not only has $2. He's still got everything that's worth having. He's got God. Now, no non-Christian can say that. I still have God. And when I have God, I am always rich. I never lose anything. I have God. Even if I don't have $2, even if I don't have a cent, I still have God. Now you might say to me, okay, you can talk like this. What do you know about it? I tell you, I know a lot about it. I have been for many times penniless. I have shared with some of you, but many times I've been penniless. I am not talking through my hat. I talk from experience. And I have rejoiced. Many times I put my hand in my pocket and I could not pull out one penny from my pocket. No, not so much as one penny. But I had God. And so long as I had God, I knew I was all right. Why? Because God is my Father. So long as I have my Father, what do I worry about? You say, is that realistic? Are you not just living in some kind of a dreamland, in a fool's paradise, or not? If I were living in a fool's paradise, I would not be preaching to you today. It is because I have seen that it is only in adverse circumstances that God's power begins to be manifested. Only in adverse circumstances. Take it. Is that not true? If you have a wonderful circumstance, where does God have the chance to do anything for you? You have wonderful health. Your bank account is healthy too. Your house is also healthy. It's not going to fall down tomorrow. Your car is running all right. Where do you need, what is God going to do for you? You can get on famously without God. I mean, who needs God? Who needs God? But when you are in trouble, when you are in adverse circumstances, when you are in difficulty, that is the time that you can see whether your God is real or not. Whether God cares for you as he says he cares for you. Does he care for you? There's your chance to see. So what are you groaning about? Somebody asked George Miller, don't you ever save up any money? No, George Miller gave away everything he had. He gave away everything he had to the poor in following God. And every time he got some money, he promptly gave it away again. So his account regularly stood a little about zero or a little bit above zero. How many Christians dare to live like that? How many dare? But you know how many millions of dollars passed through George Miller's hands to help the poor and to help the missionary? When he died, he had no money. But in his lifetime, some $8 million passed through his hands. He distributed all over to the poor and to the missionary. The same with Wesley. When he died, he had £1 something to his account. He had given everything away. But when somebody asked George Miller, don't you ever save anything in your account? I mean, isn't it dangerous to live with no money in the bank account? He said, oh no. He said, if I had a big bank account, I would never have the chance to experience through these 40 years what God can do. Has ever $8 million passed through your hand? Passed through his hand. Oh, it's wonderful what this man could do for God. Why? Because he trusted in God. How many times he came to the time when there was no food to put on the table? And he was as peaceful as ever. He didn't worry about it because he had God. He had no money, but he had God. And God never let him down. It was reading George Miller that spurred me. I was a young Christian in China at the time, and I said, if God can do it for George Miller, maybe he might consider doing it for me too. And so I launched forth in the same way, through years, having nothing but trusting in God. Now that is why I say that any Christian who does not have this attitude of joyful praise in the midst of adversity really doesn't know his God. You don't know who God. Why do you want bother to believe in God for? What do you need God for? your God is not even real. There are two kinds of attitudes. Let me come to the general, and then I'm going to narrow it back again to the Christian life. The same attitude I find so much. It is not the circumstances that determine your life, it is your attitude to those circumstances that determines your life. Never say, oh, other people have it better than I. Feel sorry for the guy who is better than you. Feel sorry for the guy. Why? If he has it better than you, if he has more money than you, if he has a... Where is he ever going to experience the reality of God? No chance, no chance. That is why the Bible often constantly speaks of woe on the rich, pitiful on the rich. They don't know what they're missing in terms of spiritual reality. And you were wanting to be rich, you don't know what's good for you. Now let's continue to look at this situation. Take a person who is crippled by a disease. Maybe a Christian is crippled by a disease too. Supposing a person is crippled by a disease, let us say poliomyelitis. Polio is a dreadful disease. Polio, if it strikes you and you survive it, will cause you to be paralyzed. And say you are paralyzed in both legs. You can never stand on your feet again. You can never walk again. What would your attitude be? Well, again, two people can have very different attitudes to the same situation. One person can say, I'm finished. I love sports so much. Now all I can ever do for the rest of my life is to roll around in a wheelchair. I'm going to be a burden to other people. I'm going to be a cabbage from now on. I can never make my contribution to society. Why does God treat me like this? Why don't other people get polio or I get polio? Oh. But there's another person who looks at the same circumstance and says, okay, I am crippled now, but I still have my mind. My hands can still move. My mind is sound. I can still make my contribution. I can still work. For after all, it is the mind that is important. I can still overcome the circumstance. And I'm sure you might think of an example. Can you think of who is an example of this? I'm sure you will know, for example, that that is exactly what happened to Franklin D. Roosevelt. Roosevelt was crippled with polio. Crippled. In the middle of his life, at the height of his career, he was 39 years old, high up in government, great prospect. He was a great sportsman. He was very athletic. He was a very active man. And he was hit by polio. He went down. And he was fighting for his life. And when he recovered, he was paralyzed in both legs, never to walk again, never to stand again on those 2 feet, except with metal braces and a cane. Never to enjoy the sports that he enjoyed so much before, crippled for life, in the middle of his life. Now he could have broken up and said, why should this thing have happened to me? I am finished for good. No. Roosevelt looked at the situation and he pulled himself together and said, okay, I am crippled for life, but that's not yet the end of me. I'm still alive. I still have my mind and my wits about me. I can still go on to make a contribution in life. And he did. He went on to become the 32nd president of the United States, as you well know. And he held the office of president longer than any other American president, for 4 terms. No other president has gone beyond 2 terms. Roosevelt held it for 4 terms. And he died in office, being president for 12 years, dying at the beginning of his 4th term. It was he who helped so much to bring America and, in that sense, the world through the Second World War, who, because he himself had this fighting spirit in the midst of adversity, was able to inspire the American people with the same spirit and say, look, it's bad, but we are going to pull through this thing together. And people knew that he was the kind of person who could pull through. After all, look at him. And therefore, whenever you see a picture of Roosevelt, what do you see? He's always going in an armchair, in a wheelchair. He's always a cripple. But did he ever look despondent? No. He went through. But I have seen so many people who have just been, who become sick, had a bad experience, became crippled a bit, or even crippled badly, and they become like cabbages. They are broken in spirit, not just broken in body. Their attitude. You see, two people look at the same situation, but what a world of difference in the attitude. What a world of difference. We know other people. Two people become blind, but how different is the attitude to the blindness? Helen Keller, we all know, was struck with blindness, most dreaded disease. We're all afraid to lose our eyesight. I mean, we might lose anything else, but not the eyesight. Helen Keller was blind, and she became so great a help to millions of people around the world that they never forget, especially what she did for the blind people. Or Beethoven. If you became deaf, what would you say? Why does God do this to me? Why should I be deaf? Beethoven didn't bother with complaining. The great composer just went on composing music. He even tried to conduct the music when he was deaf, which is something really, something so fantastic. How you manage to conduct without hearing the music. You see, that is the difference. And yet I see some people who suffer some ailments, and you talk to them and the Christian is broken. I say to this kind of person who doesn't know his God, if a non-Christian can pull through, where is the Christian today? Now, we call one kind of attitude the attitude of the pessimist. And we call the other kind of attitude the attitude of the optimist. The pessimist is the person who sees dark clouds even when the sky is blue. You look at the blue sky and you say, hey, wonderful, look at the blue sky. And the pessimist says, yeah, but do you see the cloud over there? That's the pessimist. And the optimist is exactly the difference. When you point out to him, look how dark the clouds are, he says, yeah, but look how beautiful is the silver lining. You see, the pessimist only sees the dark cloud. The optimist sees the silver lining. It's going to be good again. It's okay. Of course, we must not just be optimistic as Christians, but we also have to be realistic. If you see a silver lining in a dark cloud, when in really there is no silver lining, then you can only say this guy is living in cloud cuckoo land. You look at it and study the cloud, and there is, by the life of you, no way you can see a silver lining. And yet he keeps saying, you see the silver lining? I say, no, I don't see any silver lining. And he kept saying, oh yeah, there's a silver lining there. Well, I can only say this guy must be living in his imagination. He is living in a fool's paradise. Now, we want to be optimists, but we must have our feet standing firmly on reality. And so here I come to the fact. I mean, pessimism we can leave out altogether. For Christians, there's not anyone who's a pessimist is not so much as a Christian. We don't have to bother to talk about it. But there are also two kinds of optimism. And this is what this parable is about. You see, you can be an optimist and then feel very satisfied with yourself that you're an optimist. That's not good enough yet. You say, what? There's more to it? Yes, there's more to it. You've got to be an optimist who stands on reality. And this now brings us to this particular parable. Why? Because the Pharisee was certainly an optimist, but he was an optimist out of touch with reality. He lived in a fool's paradise. How so? Well, to illustrate what I mean, I'm going to take us back into the Old Testament first, and we're going to look at two different kinds of attitudes, and I'm going to ask you whether you think that it's realistic or pessimistic or optimistic. You see, in Numbers chapter 13, Moses sent out spies into the land of promise. Moses sent spies into the land of promise. Do you know how many spies he sent into the land of promise? That'd be interesting quiz. You know how many? 12. 12 spies he sent into the land of promise. The Israelites, God delivered them out of Egypt. He took them across the wilderness, and he was going to bring them into the land of promise. But of course, before any army strikes, you need to scout out the land. You need to know what the situation is. And so Moses sent 12 spies into the land of Canaan before he went in. to take the land. So the 12 spies went into the land of promise, the land flowing with milk and honey. They found huge clusters of grapes. They found fruit. They found luscious fields, beautiful land. Oh, this was the place. But, as they expected, people who live in such good circumstances tended to be very tall, strong, athletic, and they thought to themselves, the spies thought to themselves, wow, these are giants, men of great stature, strong people, and we by comparison are as grasshoppers. I mean, we just don't stand a chance against people like this. And so when after 40 days, the 12 spies returned to report to Moses and to the people of Israel, 10 of them said, we can't go into that land. Or it's true, it's a land of promise. It's true that there's the wonderful agricultural potential there. The fields, the land is so rich and fertile. It is true, you see, look at these big clusters of grapes, this great cluster of grapes that we have brought back. And look at this fruit, beautiful fruit. But you see, people who lived in those circumstances, feeding on milk and honey, are going to grow very tall, 6 footers, all of them. And we are all only 5'2". I mean, look at these guys, how are we going to fight them? So these 10 of the spies reported negatively. The land is good, but we can't take it. They are too strong for us. No way we can fight these people. Out of the 12, only 2 said, that is Joshua and Caleb, only these 2 said, it's true. Not only is the land rich, but the people are big, they are strong. But our God is with us. God is with us. We shall prevail. Let us go forward and take the land. Who was an optimist? Who was a pessimist? Who was a realist? Well, you say the 10 spies were realists, weren't they? I mean, they did see the people were so tall and strong, and that they did realize the circumstances were difficult. Now, Joshua and Caleb, the other 2, they were outvoted, of course. Majority is always right. You think so? In the Bible, the majority is always wrong. Have you ever realized this? The majority, 10-2, there is the 2 are completely outvoted. And not only outvoted, the whole multitude, of course, accepted the report of the 10 and rejected the report of the 2. Now, were these spies realistic, those 10 spies? They were realistic. They were realistic. It is true what they said. So what was their mistake? They left out one factor, God. Now, did they believe in God? Of course they believed in God. They were Israelites. They were of the people of God. They had received the covenant. They were Israelites. Sure, they believe in God. And this shows you the 2 different characters, the 2 different types of Christians also today. The one looks at the problem and gives up. Does he believe in God? Sure, he believes in God. So what's the difference between his believing in God and the believing of God of the other 2, who said, no, our God will give us the victory? You say, that's optimistic, but out of touch with reality. I mean, since when can 5'2" people fight 6'2" people? I mean, in this day of machine guns, your height gives you a bigger target. And that's better. You're bigger, I can get you more easily because you're a bigger target. But in those days when you fight with the sword, it doesn't work that way. Strength and height and reach count a lot, you know. You don't pit a welterweight against a heavyweight. I mean, he is so much stronger than you. That's not a fair fight, you know. So, what is the distinction between these 2 attitudes? The distinction is this, that though both of them believed in God, the one group simply received God as a factor. They believed in God as one factor among many factors. Now, when God is only one factor in your life among many other factors, that is a very dangerous situation. Very dangerous situation, as we are going to see from the attitude of the Pharisee. But for Joshua and Caleb, the minority always, God was the determining factor, not just one factor among many, but the determining factor. Now I wonder which group of Christians you belong to. It's here that you're going to sort out the wheat from the tares. And because of the report of those 10 spies, you know what happened? They destroyed the whole of Israel, of that generation. They destroyed Israel. That generation perished in the wilderness because they listened to these 10 spies. They took the same attitude as those 10 spies, and they did not want to go into the promised land. They said, no, we cannot fight them. Didn't they tell us? They are so tall, they are so strong. It's no use. And then what did they do? The next chapter, chapter 14 in Numbers, says they began to grumble and murmur against God. Why did God bring us out of Egypt? I mean, we were slaves in Egypt, it's true, but at least we had enough food to eat. Now we are here stuck in the middle of the wilderness, and we cannot go into the promised land. Because all that will happen to us when we go into the promised land is we'll be chopped down. They'll make mincemeat of us. They're too strong for us. Did God bring us out of Egypt to kill us here? Either to kill us in the wilderness or kill us in the promised land? All that he wanted to do is to destroy us. They murmured against God. And they murmured against Moses. And in fact, Moses was in danger of his life. And so was Joshua and Caleb. They wanted to stone Joshua and Caleb as well if God hadn't intervened. But because of their attitude, notice the word, not the event. You see, the 10 spies and the 2 spies, they looked at exactly the same event, but their attitude to those events was entirely different. The result was that because the majority took the attitude of those 10 spies, they perished in the wilderness. They never entered the promised land. In fact, only Joshua and Caleb of that generation entered the promised land. All the others perished in the wilderness. I say again, it is not the events that will determine your life, but your attitude to those events as a Christian are so important to grasp the situation. It is absolutely essential to grasp the situation. These 10 spies, remember this again, I say to you, they all believed in God. They all belonged to the covenant people, the chosen people. And they were hand-picked, mind you, chosen to do that job. But for them, God was just one factor among many. One factor among many. Not enough to turn the balance of their life. Not enough to make a difference to the balance of their life. Only when God becomes the determining factor of your life, will you be able to persevere in the face of adversity? He determines my life. He is the one factor that counts. And when God is the determining factor in your life, oh, the difference is incalculable. I look at the same situation, and I look at God, and I look at the situation again, and I look at God, and I said, it can be done. Am I a realist or am I not a realist? That answer depends on whether God is real to you or not, isn't it? Is God a reality or is he not a reality? Now I say to you, if God is not a reality, don't bother to go to church. Forget about Christianity. Forget about religion. Because that faith will in the end be more damaging to you than be helpful to you. There are some people who only have enough faith to make them feel good, but not enough faith to make them be good. The world is different. If your faith is simply an opium to make you feel good, you better do without the opium. Forget it. Just drop religion, drop Christianity. I preach as straight as that. I don't mince my words. I don't fool around with religion. I have no time to fool around with religion. We are talking about reality. Is God real or is he not real? If God is not real, then we don't need religion. No news for religion. Who wants to live in a fool's paradise? Who wants enough religion just to make you feel good? And when the bubble bursts, it's a very bad letdown. Anyone who goes on drugs knows this situation. It feels good while the drug is working. But when you come to again, you'll feel awful. you'll feel awful. No, no, we don't want that kind of Christianity. We don't need this kind of religion. We don't need God if He is not real. Build your faith on reality. But that raises the question. How do you know whether God is real or not? How do you know? Now that's exactly what the parable is telling us. The path of how you come to know God as reality.